a rollicking song from Bob Seger, the title track from his 2004 album Face the Promise, about a guy seeking the promised land in various forms. For the next 2 hours, we will hear various stories about people who are on sort of a similar quest. You know, when you think about cults, you hear the word cults. Maybe the Manson clan comes to mind, or Jim Jones and what happened at Guyana, or maybe that San Diego UFO cult where everyone ended up dead. The cult we're going to learn about in the next part of the program didn't end up quite that way, but there were victims, casualties, losses, life-altering consequences for those involved, and who knows where it could have gone. The focus of Enlightenment Next, that's the name of the group, is a guy named Andrew Cohen, who became a sort of a guru. He's a gifted guy, charismatic, but kind of, as we'll hear, he kind of let all of this ultimately go to his head. There's a new TV series that describes the evolution of this group, this cult, how the trouble started, how it all came crashing down, and we're going to meet two of the principals involved in it in just a moment. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Megan Gibson is an award-winning journalist, storyteller, and TV producer. She's the director of the Conscious 2 TV series, How I Created a Cult. Has a lot of experience in films and commercials and broadcast television programs. Alex Howard is an entrepreneur, author, and psychotherapist. He founded something called the Optimum Health Clinic in the UK and is also the founder and CEO of Conscious 2. And we're going to hear what that is in just a moment. Alex and Megan, welcome to the program.
Hi, George.
Alex, I'm going to start with you. Tell me what Conscious 2 is, how you founded it, and what its focus is, and how you landed this particular project.
So Conscious 2 is an online platform for mindfulness, yoga, and conscious living. And really, it was an attempt to create a platform where we could create discussion and have online courses and workshops to support people in living a more conscious life. And this work, this series was basically came about because I came across the story of Andrew Cohen and Enlighten Next. And it just seemed like something that needed to be turned into a series. It felt like the questions and the kind of topics that it was raising were just the kind of thing that we don't normally talk about in these kind of circles. We do a lot of online courses and workshops with spiritual teachers, and we have some amazing kind of content there. But it feels like in these circles, what they generally do is talk about the light, and they talk about what's good. And of course, we all have amazing potential, and we all have the capacity to do amazing things. And yet, spiritual groups and spiritual teachings, they also have shadows, and they also have darker sides in terms of what goes on. And we felt with Conscious 2, we wanted to create a platform that is a little bit like having a really good therapeutic relationship. In a really good therapeutic relationship, you have nurturing, you have support, you have warmth, you have kind of softness, but you also have challenge, and you also have provocation. You also have someone that's able to give you a kind of kick in the bum when you need it. And we felt with Conscious 2, as we were developing the mission and the vision, that we had this content with many wonderful teachers and many support, but we also wanted to look at the other side. And we wanted to find a way to have the conversations within spiritual communities that people often don't have. And Andrew Cohen and Enlighten Next, of course, we'll get into, I'm sure, the story as we come through the interview. There were some wonderful things that happened. There are people that talk about having life-changing experiences, but there were also some pretty dark things that happened. And there are reasons, you know, for that that we can come into.
Well, we'll get into those. Megan, how is it that you came to this project? I mean, that's How I Created a Cult. That's a pretty meaty-sounding title.
Yes, it is. I was actually approached by Alex. We have a mutual friend and working partner together, and he recommended, or Alex had pitched him on the project and said, you know, I have this idea that I think I want to do, but I need the right person to direct it. And our mutual friend Stuart said, I know the person, but she'll never do it. She doesn't have the time. And then I had like 5 minute Skype conversation with Alex, and he told me what his idea was and what he wanted to do. And it was immediately a yes. I have a very brief history, and already knew about this organization, from an experience about 11 years ago. So I was familiar with the organization and with, Andrew Cohen, the leader, and was definitely interested right out of the gate.
Give me the broad strokes about the series, how people see it, and then we're going to get into the meat of the story. So it's six parts?
That's correct. Yeah,
sorry, Megan, you go.
Yeah, Megan, why don't you take that one, and then we'll come back to Alex in a second.
Okay, so it's a six-part series that's right now proprietary to conscious2.com, and essentially the organization itself was alive and well for 27 years. And so across several different continents, so just the scope of the actual time period in which this all took place from about 1986 till about 3 years ago was so large that we wanted to give it justice, as well as the fact that it's just a complicated story when you pull back and look at how cults form, what the commonalities are between them. Then when you put genuine spiritual practice on top of that, or the premise of that, there's so much to tease apart that we really wanted to give it time. There's another documentary that's out right now, Holy Hell, and that's just a feature-length documentary about the Buddhafield cult in California, and that's a feature-length documentary, and in a feature-length documentary, you can't really dive that deep. It's a great doc, and I appreciated it, and I really respect what they did. However, we wanted to get just a bit deeper and ask a little bit larger questions about spirituality, about the path, about what conscious pursuit really means in a safe environment and in situations where you have cults and things like crazy wisdom, as they say in the business, if you will. Does the end justify the means if people are actually making quote unquote breakthroughs? So we wanted to kind of more deeply go into all of those things, and that took 6 hours.
I had never heard of Andrew Cohen before, but certainly I've only seen the first two of the 6 hours, and it's mesmerizing stuff. What really grabbed my attention is the interviews with all these folks. Everybody I've seen interviewed in this, I liked them. I liked the characters, the real people. They're all open and honest, and they're seeking enlightenment, and they're likable, smart people. And you wonder, how do you find yourself in this? Because in the beginning, early on, the interviewees say, oh my gosh, we always joked about being in a cult, and turns out we are in one. How do smart people like these folks you talk to not know that they're in something like this?
I think one other thing, George, of this series that we were particularly fascinated by is that I think we all have assumptions about the kind of people that join a cult. And we assume that they're going to be people which are not necessarily that intelligent. They're going to be people that are a little bit gullible. Perhaps they're looking for some kind of parental figure which is going to provide them with kind of something they haven't got inside of themselves. And maybe that's true in some cult-like organizations, but that certainly wasn't true with Andrew Cohen and Enlightened Next. And that was one of the things that for Megan and I was particularly fascinating about this group, was that these were actually highly intelligent people, very capable people. And interestingly, that there's a lot of controversy around different perspectives, different things that happened. But interestingly, one of the things that pretty much everyone that was within this organization, outside of this organization, that has kind of critiqued this organization, pretty much everyone has agreed upon, is that these were intelligent people. And they were, in a sense, perhaps their shared flaw, if you want to put it like that, is they were idealistic. And they believed that, something was possible that perhaps in hindsight they might now see differently. But I think it's also important to say that no one joins a cult. People don't go kind of, this looks like a great cult, let's go and join this cult. People join something because they're drawn towards the potential, the in the early years, especially pretty much all students, had powerful spiritual experiences. And that was the that was what got them hooked. That was what made them want to dive in for more.
Well, Megan, maybe you can describe some of those experiences, because I heard the superlatives that are used by the people you interviewed. You know, these breakthroughs we had and this enlightenment we had. And I'm trying to think, help me understand it, because I haven't had that experience.
That has been, from the very beginning, the thing that I knew that was going to be the most challenging, especially since we did want to give a balanced point of view. It wasn't all bad, as much as everybody would like to only remember that part sometimes. There were things that were incredibly good. That was the reason that they stayed. That was the reason that they got involved as deep as they did from the beginning. And when we get into these kind of esoteric shared experiences or individualistic experiences, they're really, really hard to explain. Because even though, not that it's like a near-death experience, but when you hear people describe a near-death experience of there's often a spiritual component to that, and there's also often shared components of that people, see a white light or whatever. And so it's similar in these kinds of spiritual awakening experiences. I find that people often use the same language to describe their experience and what they feel happened. But there's not a whole lot of empirical data to support or to point to that would say that this is exactly what is happening. So that was definitely the most challenging part, but really at its core, it sounds a lot like a dismissing of all of the anxieties that make you an individual person. If you're, if you're worried about your appearance, or if you're, worried about what people are going to think about what you're saying, or all of these things that make you self-conscious or inhibited, they all just kind of fall away, and any concerns that you have about your individual self become completely unimportant. It all just sounds like kind of oneness. It's a oneness experience of both with yourself and all of mankind and the earth and the universe, et cetera.
Well, for those of us who haven't been through this, it sounds a little woo-woo, and without my anxieties, I'm not sure what would be left over.
That's actually totally the point. It's there really isn't a whole lot of yourself left over. Everything that is left over is essentially, there's a practice that if you want to figure out what God is, you just keep asking yourself questions. Who am I? And, I'm a mother, for instance. Well, what if I wasn't a mother? Who would I be? Well, I guess I would be a woman. Okay, well, if you weren't a woman, what would you be? And once you strip back all of those things, what's left? And, in kind of Buddhist terms, nothing. And then that's, as close as you can get to God, so to speak, in some circles. Now, lots of people who believe in God would say that it's the opposite. But, it gets really, really difficult to explain in words.
Well, obviously these people are getting something out of it, or they wouldn't have stuck around, as you said. Alex. Yeah, Alex, can you tell us, introduce this central character, Andrew Cohen, sort of describe in a nutshell his rise, where he was coming from, what his teachings were?
That's a harder question than you might think.
Yeah.
Andrew was grew up in New York in a Jewish environment. In his early 20s, he went to India and had various spiritual experiences. He particularly had experiences with a teacher called Punja or Papaji, who was effectively a non-duality teacher. And non-duality is basically the idea that we are all one, there is no kind of separation. And often people have these powerful, people can have these powerful experiences, a little bit like Megan was describing, of disappearing of a sense of self. And he had some very powerful experiences very quickly. And in fact, within 3 weeks of being with his teacher said to him, effectively, you are enlightened, you are ready to go off and teach. And one of the things we get into in the second episode is this idea of lineage, and this idea of, in most spiritual traditions, teachings are handed down through many generations of teacher. And there's a kind of set of check and balances and a support structure, let's say, that sits behind that. So it's interesting that the very early on, Andrew had these experiences, was told he was enlightened. There wasn't a substantial lineage that was behind him. And he went off to teach. And one of the things that Megan was just saying around this kind of this loss of anxiety, well, Andrew, one of the very powerful characteristics of his, I guess, his charisma and the way that people experienced him was he was utterly doubtless. He had, after these experiences as a teacher, and he went to teach, and his teacher told him to never doubt himself, that he just absolutely, wholeheartedly, and fully embodiedly believed that he was enlightened, and therefore his ideas were absolutely the truth and the way that it was. And it's interesting, if you look at cults and you look at, we broaden the definition of cult beyond just spiritual cults to people blindly following a leader or an idea, there's something very powerful about that lack of self-doubt. And people would sit with Andrew and they would have powerful, as we talked about, powerful spiritual experiences. And then people started to follow him. And he started off in the UK, here in England, in the UK, and he gathered a little bit of a following. And then he, in time, moved to Mill Valley in California, and for a number of years had a growing community there, before eventually moving to Fox Hollow, which is in Lenox in Massachusetts. And the big, large center that the community lived in there. There were also centers in London, Amsterdam, Paris, a number of other cities around the world. So at its peak, it was a substantial organization with a significant number of people that were students of some sort in the low thousands.
Megan, this idea, his teacher tells him that he's enlightened, go forth and teach, and he takes it sort of literally. And as you explore in the film, he sort of thinks of himself almost as, in the view of some of his students or followers, thinks of himself as sort of the equivalent of the Buddha. I mean, it's one thing to not have any doubt. It's another to think that you're basically you're perfect and you have, as you say in the film, no shadow.
Mm-hmm.
We could call that megalomania too, I guess.
Yeah, there's a lot of characteristics. You know, there's a book out called Prophetic Charisma, excuse me, and it kind of details the commonalities between charismatic leaders, and they all have this kind of this thought process. It's that, you know, they're either completely charismatic or messianic, so they either think they're the second coming or, you know, the Buddha reincarnate, or they're just completely doubtless and have a lot of charisma. And Andrew certainly leaned more on the side of charisma, but especially at the beginning, back in the late 80s, that's how people were characterizing him. It was so incredible what people were experiencing in his presence, that they said it was like the Buddha is here. It was like, you know, being in the time of the Buddha or in the time of Jesus, that it was just that incredible of an experience. And it's important to say that back in the 80s, it really was more of an experiential thing that people were after. People were just coming to sit with him and bask in this feeling that would come upon them when they were in his presence. There wasn't a whole heck of a lot of a community. It just kind of automatically happened around him because of a confluence of events, mainly because he had attracted a bunch of European people that were around India when he was enlightened. They all saw kind of this transformation happen in him and then started following him. And eventually when he came to the US, they also followed him. And so he had a bunch of Europeans who didn't have work visas around, and it automatically just generated this following, which obviously attracted more attention and got more people involved.
And gave him an inordinate amount of power over his followers. We're going to get into sort of how this developed and how things went sour with my guests, Megan Gibson and Alex Howard, talking about guru Andrew Cohen. Much more to come here on Coast. A rollicking song from the Beatles, Helter Skelter, a classic of theirs, a song that was misappropriated by a now infamous cult leader, Charlie Manson, who thought that the band was speaking to him secretly through their lyrics. We're talking about cult leader Andrew Cohen with producer Megan Gibson and Alex Howard, who've combined for a six-hour series about how a cult is built, and we'll come back in a moment and find out how this one in particular fell apart. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Megan, in your series, there are clips, film clips, video clips of Andrew Cohen from years, his early years when he's teaching in Europe and other places, and the descriptions of him as brash and arrogant and confident, charismatic, an authentic genius, one person said. I mean, you can see it. He's affable. He's humorous. You could see how he could generate followers. But when we mean followers, we don't just mean they come to hear him teach. I mean, as we just heard a couple of minutes ago from Alex, they followed him across the country. They uprooted everything.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, people came from literally all over Europe, England mainly, but all over Europe, Israel, Holland, Germany, I mean, everywhere, and followed him to the U.S. Obviously, it was Eastern Massachusetts to begin with, and then they decided they wanted to move to California. Everybody uprooted and left and went with him. And then after 7 years in California, he decided he wanted to go back to the East Coast and ended up back in Massachusetts, and everybody went there. And not only that, but once they developed or bought this large piece of property for $2.8 million up in the Berkshire Mountains in Massachusetts, everybody had to pay to get in, which, you know, was kind of self-contained, and they had their own, you know, kitchens and their own living quarters. And so obviously there's a cost to that, but everybody had to pay depending on how long they had been with him. So he definitely, you know, that's the thing that gives this so much legitimacy to me. It's not just this crazy utopian community of people that wanted to be together. They must have really felt something. Like, I imagined what would cause me to uproot my life like that and, you know, in a lot of cases, put my career completely on hold, you know, move my children several times, what would make me do that? And what they experienced with him must have been incredibly real. That's the only conclusion that I can come to, really.
Alex, at some point when you have to quit your job, sell your house, sometimes say goodbye not only to loved ones and friends, but your spouse, and then that separation becomes reinforced, where you're living in an enclave and you're really discouraged from any kind of outside contact. That would sort of dawn on me. I guess maybe if I were enlightened, it wouldn't occur to me that it seemed weird, but it certainly did start to creep into people's consciousness at some point.
Yeah, I think one of the things that happens is after a while, you're kind of in a bubble, and everyone around you is sharing the same set of beliefs. And one of the defining characteristics of a cult is that people do step away from the things, the people that would challenge their beliefs. So if you're just going and seeing a teacher and then you come home to your life and you're surrounded by popular culture and you're surrounded by your friends and your family, there's a certain anchoring in normal reality, let's say, that goes with that. When you are living with people that are also sharing the worldview that you are, and you are being exposed to that day in, day out. Being a student of Andrew Cohen and Enlightened Next was also very grueling. People would do many hours a day of meditation practice and prostrations, which is effectively a physical practice of bowing down and doing that sometimes 1,000 times a day. And so there's also a certain and this was deliberate, a sense of breaking down of the ego structure. But in doing that, you're also breaking down someone's own capacity to question. And so some of the more destructive and dysfunctional elements of the organization came about. I think if people came in and just saw that right out the bat, they would be more likely to go, hang on, this is crazy. Like, what's happening? And yet, people in the early years of their experience, often they wouldn't see so many of these things. They would, the teaching would focus more on having the powerful experiences of either no self or kind of spiritual experiences, and the more intense and destructive elements tended to come more online as someone was deeper into the organization. And, you know, it's interesting. I was just thinking recently, it's not a great example, but in some ways, it's a little bit like someone's Facebook feed. What happens in someone's Facebook feed is that they tend to like the people that they like, and they tend to follow the news sources that they agree with and share their worldview. They tend to be friends with people that see the world in the same way that they do. And so after a while, we can somewhat control the challenge that we have, the dialogue that we have, the way that we see things. And we see this in a moment in the political landscape, that on both sides of the equation, that people feel more and more endorsed in their perspective, and they tend to gather more information that supports them in that way. And that's one of the powerful forces I think happens within a cult, is that people, they get less and less challenged over time, and when they start to question what's happening themselves, anyone that might support those questions is actually going to reinforce the position that they're trying to question against.
And Megan, at some point, you know, it starts out as teacher-student relationship, then it becomes sort of guru-disciple, and in some ways it's an infatuation. It's like a love affair, like when you're first in love and you can't think of anything else, and you throw away reason, and you don't want anybody to question anything. You don't question anything yourself, and then stuff happens in that early blissful period that should be a warning sign, but you don't really face it until you're in the middle of the messy divorce.
Exactly. In fact, one of the students that was kind of on the periphery, Lonnie, says as much in his interview in the show, is that, you know, the guru paradigm itself, and that's kind of what separates this also from just a spiritual teacher and some students, they had a guru paradigm, and that was on purpose. The teaching that Andrew got from his teacher was a guru. And in a guru relationship, there's a direct transference of love feelings, and you do surrender to the love that you feel with the guru, and it emulates that kind of a relationship, absolutely. And one of the things that happens is that you just abandon all of the concerns that you have about, you know, that person. And just like when you're falling in love with a partner, any of the little things that you think aren't that big of a deal are going to be the things that are the biggest deal in the world after 7 or 10 years, and you're looking at your partner wondering what kind of a choice you made, and, oh, I guess all these things were true when I decided to be with them and marry them for the rest of my life. But that's exactly what happened with Andrew, is that people had such incredible love experiences and were so moved by their experiences by him that they just abandoned all the things that looked either dangerous or concerning. And in the later years, you know, it wasn't just that this happened, you know, 30 years ago and these people stuck with him. He continued to bring in students for all 27 years. And some of the younger people that we interviewed that were in at the end said that they had absolutely no interest in him, that they found him, you know, completely crass and obnoxious and didn't trust him at all, and knew that he was in a cult. Like they understood from looking from afar that, oh, wow, this is totally a cult. And then had these incredibly transformative experiences that they weren't even looking for, that just happened on accident because they were in proximity of him, hadn't gone to hear him speak, had gone to hear someone else speak, and had these experiences. And even knowing all of that, just completely abandoned their intuition because what they had, the experience that they had, was so powerful.
Early, I think in the first hour, you have some interviews with his followers who describe this thing that happened on the East Coast early in his career, of this summer of love, they called it, and they were blissful, and it was like a romance, and they followed him across the country. And then once they got on the West Coast, there was a lot of love, but not in a physical sense. That was there's a lot of weird stuff that goes on, but it wasn't a sex cult, right, Megan?
Yeah.
You could start with
absolutely.
That.
Yeah, I think, and that was one of the things that I think during this time period, you know, in the mid 80s, we had just been coming out as a culture, been coming out of some of these other communities that had, you know, certainly 60s culture, there had been a lot of love shared literally, physically, sexually between, you know, large communities, and there's kind of this liberation happening, and Andrew's community stood out because there was no sexual impropriety, either by Andrew the Guru or by any of his students. There were several, you know, marriages and relationships, but most of the relationships, committed relationships in his community broke up. And then when they were in California, he also instituted celibacy practices. In addition to all the other stuff, the meditation and the prostrations and the bowing that everyone was doing, he also instituted celibacy for certain people, depending on, you know, one gentleman, Hal Blacker, who was in the community, he found out later it was just because he was flirtatious. So he took a vow of celibacy, and lots of people did it voluntarily. Lots of people were recommended that they take vows of celibacy. And so essentially they shaved their heads and just abstained from any sort of sexual activity for years. Some of these people, a decade or more. And they would all live together in the same house, kind of going to what Alex was saying earlier, that they would just live together so that they could reinforce this kind of inquisitive nature around the you know, sexuality and culture and among themselves. So yeah, there was none of the normal things that give out cult behaviors. There was no drugs. It was a completely clean environment. They were all vegan, from what I understand. There was no sex. So all the things that would typically make a leader controversial or make people take pause, those were all kind of on the up and up. And so people were like, well, if we're gonna be in a community like this, and no one was calling it a cult in the early 80s or 90s, you know, if we're gonna join a community, this one seems to be the safest, because there's no sex, and the guru's on the up and up, and he was married and had absolutely, you know, there's no impropriety in that way. So it may have actually come off as being a safer place to go and pursue this kind of living.
But Alex, things got pretty weird. I mean, you didn't have sex and drugs, but things certainly grew increasingly weird, and Andrew became nasty, cruel, kind of harsh, tightened the screws, you know, in addition to requiring celibacy and shave your head kind of stuff. He started berating people, insulting them, embarrassing them. Describe that process.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's definitely one of the darker sides of what happened, that Andrew definitely had a vicious temper and way of kind of tempering, I'd say, his students. And in fact, in the opening part of the trailer, which is obviously free to view online, people can see it at howicreatedacult.com, you literally hear about a 30-second clip of Andrew just ripping into a woman. And one of the things that people often said is that they weren't really sometimes even clear why it was happening. It wasn't like if you followed these five rules, then you would be okay. It was kind of a constant changing. And what Andrew was looking for was any sign of someone's ego kind of rising up. He had this idea of the collective is more important than the individual. So anywhere where there was a sign of an individual valuing their own needs as more important than the group, that would be a chance to verbally attack someone and cut them down. It was also this bred a culture of that within the organization as well. And relatively early on, they started having men's group and women's groups. So the men would all get together in smaller groups, and the women would get together. And this culture was bred where if someone was seen to be, you could say if someone was seen to be questioning things or being defiant, they would be verbally attacked, and often viciously so. And often, if they were in a group, it would be an entire group of people taking in terms to gradually tear that person down. And you can see how if someone is being selfish or someone's being egotistical, you can see the value sometimes of challenging that and helping someone see that. But there was a viciousness and a cruelty in how that was done. And I know that a number of the former students now, as they look back on those times, that they were just normalized to treating each other in that way. They were normalized to Andrew being towards people in that way. They look back, and some of them feel a great deal of obviously people feel trauma of being on the receiving end of that, but people also feel some trauma of being architects of that they had been trained to treat and behave in a certain way. And one of the other sides of this equation was that in this guru relationship with Andrew that, of course, people were constantly failing to reach this kind of moving standard of what was expected, that they were also then expected to apologize. And the source of the apologies was often writing very long and deeply self-deprecating letters of apology and begging for forgiveness and buying large bouquets of flowers and sometimes donating large amounts of money. There's a constant way to try and win back the guru's good favor. And as people gradually rose up in the organization, what would then happen is if they got too big for themselves, they would be cut right back down. And that would look like being on the end of these vicious verbal attacks. But it would also mean that people were grouped in houses based upon their apparent evolution and development at that point. And so if someone was stepping out of line or they were in some ways challenging or questioning too much, they would not only would they be being attacked, but they would have to move out of their house and move back down to a house with people which were considered lower level students. So there was a constant disrupting of people's sense of holding and safety as a way of appropriately, as it was thought at that time, trying to challenge them to wake up. Of course, hindsight is a very different perspective on that.
And Megan, a couple people, I mean, some were just kicked out altogether. Look, you've moved across the country, you quit your job, you gave up your career, you sold your house, you're doing menial labor, scrubbing toilets or whatever, and giving up whatever you have to support this guy who's all of his needs are taken care of. And then because you question something or raise an issue, out you go. You don't have anything. You've got kids in tow and you've got nothing, nowhere to go.
Absolutely. Plenty of people were kicked out. And, you know, I didn't, it's funny that you bring that up because I never heard a single story where someone was kicked out and stayed out. If they left, it was on their own volition, that they made their way back in and then decided, and I'm not saying that didn't happen, but all the stories that I've heard, it was you were kicked out and then you just fought tooth and nail to prove that you deserved to be back in.
Well, how about the guy with the English accent who's interviewed in Silhouette?
That's a woman, actually. We've
Okay.
But Marlo Sand, who's in, it's a pseudonym. She's actually an author and has written a book about her experience called Paradise and Promises. She went through a lot as well and had small children and was, you know, kicked out of her house, as Alex described, for not, you know, living the teachings, as they would say. If you weren't living the teachings, which meant that you were able to describe the teachings, you were able to speak about them eloquently and intelligently, and you were also demonstrating that you were living them. So you were, your speech was, you know, in it, consistent, your behavior was consistent. And if you weren't, you know, living the teachings according to the people around you in your house, you would be kicked out or demoted, oftentimes with no notice. And a lot of these people had children and they would just literally have to pack up and go in the middle of the night sometimes and find another place to live. And whether that was, you know, another one of the houses that was demotion or just literally find another place to live spontaneously. I can't even imagine trying to fight to get back into that kind of a community.
Oh my gosh. Well, you know, as you describe in the first two parts, it sounds like something approaching rampant paranoia. They go through something called the Holocaust period that gets really weird. It is encouraged that you tell tales about the people who are living with you, that you rat them out if they commit some sort of a perceived transgression. Mm-hmm. And all of this kind of comes to a head in 2013. When we come back, we're going to get into that story, how Andrew Cohen is confronted by some of his senior students and what happens after that. Much more to come here as we discuss this TV series, How to Create a Cult, here on Coast to Coast AM.